single horrendous paroxysm, his insides came flying out his mouth. Hot blood mixed with shredded lung tissue splattered against Ryan's hood and chest. Other SecMen ignored Kisser's final spasms. They frantically unbuckled their safety harnesses and charged their weapons. Again the WAG rocked, this time by a deafening explosion that lifted the vehicle high into the air. The wave of intense heat that slammed them said only one thing to Ryan. Thermite. One of two things was going to happen, JB thought as he crouched behind a heap of concrete chunks. They were either going to get Ryan back, or they were going to piss off the black armored people in a real big way. He had easily moved into position in the same general area as the sniper, on the south end of Moonboy's main street. No one had fired on him, and he'd seen no sign of anti-personnel tripwires. Down the road, five people in black were hard at work on the missile. They had unscrewed panels along the sides of the nose cone and hooked up cables that connected it to what had to be a launch control computer across the street. They were getting the white and red bird ready to fly. Where and for what purpose, JB didn't have a clue. Furthermore, he didn't care. He knew the target, if there was one, couldn't amount to much. Deathlands had nothing left worth nuking. In drawing up his spur-of-the-moment attack plan, he had assumed that the black armor that shielded both the people and their aircraft provided an impenetrable defense against blaster slugs. The canny sniper might have been the lousiest shot this side of the Shens, but Ryan's skill was triple wicked, and he hadn't been able to do any damage to the aircraft. JB had reasoned that if the people in black and their black plane couldn't be hurt by blaster fire, perhaps the white rocket could. This unproved weakness was the basis of his strategy. That and the fact that the missile was plenty valuable. A lot more valuable than Ryan. JB figured they could encourage the bastards to make a trade for Ryan by threatening to ventilate the rocket with bullet holes. In the back of his mind, he knew he was grasping at straws, but time was running out, and nobody else had come up with anything better. The key to running a bluff like that was in making sure the enemy believed you were willing to die in order to win. The traitor had taught him that. He'd also taught him that once you got your edge, once you had the enemy rocked back on their heels, you had to push that advantage to the wall, until the bastards were chilled or otherwise knocked out of the fight. Sometimes going in like a bunch of crazies was the only way to win. Sometimes it was just suicide. None of their short-barreled weapons were particularly accurate past 100 yards. But the missile was big, and they didn't care where they hit it. They were about to split up to take their attack positions.
If they give us any shit after the shooting starts, aim for the bottom stage of the missile. That's where most of the fuel is. Bastards have to think we're ready to blow them back to where they came from.
JB had no idea if Ryan was even still alive, and if he was alive, if there was any way to bring him safely back from wherever he'd been taken. It occurred to him that perhaps this was already a lost cause, that in the great scheme of things, there was some other field of battle that John Barrymore Dix was scheduled to die on. The armorer looked around. This battleground was as good as any, he decided. Flat, dry, lots of broken cover, still plenty of daylight left. And the cause? Friendship. Rescue. Revenge. Success was well worth a seat on the last train west, if that was what it came to. When he had given the others enough time to get into position, he checked his Uzi, drawing back the charging lever just far enough to catch the glint of brass that indicated a live round in the chamber. Then he cleared out his mind and let his anger build. Rage was good. He drew a deep breath, cupped his hand to his mouth, and shouted over to Main Street.
Hey! Hey, assholes!
Short of the sprawling profusion of Moonboy's shacks and lean-tos, Christy paused and crouched behind a chunk of sloping cinderblock wall, her Smith & Wesson revolver in her hand. A step or two back, Mildred dropped to one knee, looking for targets over the barrel of her check-built .38. 20 yards from the outskirts of the ville proper, the unmistakable scent of death hung heavy in the air. Both of the women had toured the aftermath of massacres before. They shared a look, steeling themselves for what they expected to find. Christy broke from cover, running low and quick to the edge of the ramshackle structures. Doors were a luxury here. The residents used sheets of plastic to cover the entrances, or did without. Floors, other than tamped dirt, were a rarity. She looked inside a shack. The reek of death was mixed with something else, a smell so sharp that it made Christie's throat clamp shut. There was no tangle of bodies on the ground, only a wide brown patch where some liquid had dried on the dirt. Along one wall was a low shelf made of scavenged brick and a narrow piece of sheet metal. On it sat three crudely fashioned straw dolls, a couple of badly chipped enamel pots, a broken piece of yardstick, and a tin measuring cup. Mildred looked over her shoulder, first at the meager belongings, then at the dark patch.
The foam they used on the canny. They must have used the same thing on these people after they chilled them, to tidy things up.
Let's go, Mildred.
Christie pushed on, turning down a well-worn path. She wasn't looking for signs of life, but she couldn't even find signs of death, except for the cloying funk in the air and the earth that seemed to be stained on every side. As she worked her way down the lane that twisted between the deserted shacks, Christie avoided stepping on the patches. Though her brain told her what Mildred said had to be true, it was hard for her to believe that all the stains had once been people. Hard for her to believe that in death, so many had been so easily disposed of. Even though this had been a pure Normville, even though these townsfolk would have strung her up from the nearest lamp pole if they had been alive, Christie felt pity for them. As they approached a firing position that would give them the entire 100-foot broadside of the missile for a target, Christie saw something on the path that made her stop short. She dropped to one knee so Mildred could see what lay ahead. Not all the corpses had been liquefied. In the middle of the lane was a scatter of chunked body parts. Christie had never seen such systematic destruction of human beings. She and Mildred counted the boots. It was the only way they could even guess how many people had died there. 6 boots, 4 large, 2 small, equaled 3 people who had been chopped to bits. Yet there was no blood to be seen.
Either these cannies were hacked up someplace else and dumped here, or this is a spot we don't want to spend much time in.
Maybe we'd better go around.
She took one step off the track, and the rat trap snapped. Dirt-colored spheres jumped into the air and started to spin. Christie knew what they were. In that split second, she knew.
No.
The negation was more than a thought. Connected instantly, instinctively to her Muti Gaia power source, it was a tangible and awesome force. Before the laser mines could fire, Christie's body unleashed a blast wave of pure energy in all directions. It slammed Mildred to the earth, and it tipped the spheres out of synchronization. Laser beams discharged according to their program, but they weren't reflected. They shot off into space or sizzled into the ground. Their cat's cradle broken, in less than 2 seconds the spheres dropped back to Earth. Christie was so drained by the sudden all-out effort that she could barely breathe. Her skin was on fire, her heart laboring. She staggered back, fighting to maintain her balance, but her legs were failing, and darkness was closing in at the edges of her vision. She couldn't let herself pass out. She had to help Mildred get to her feet. They had to fulfill their part of the plan to save Ryan. But it wasn't to be. Close to death, she collapsed in a heap beside her friend. At the north end of Moon Boy, Doc, Dean, and Jack stood side by side behind the cover of a partially collapsed porch. They had their hand blasters drawn and faced the aft end of the ballistic missile and the backsides of the 4 figures in black.
You realize, lads, that if we do manage to perforate the hide of that vile projectile, the resulting conflagration could consume everything within this canyon's walls, which would surely buy us all passage on Charon's barge.
Jack and Dean just stared at him.
Styx, lads, the river of no return, across which the son of Erebus ferries every child born of woman. You must have heard of it.
Sure, Doc.
The teenager frowned.
No river here. Chill time, Doc. Blaster up.
What? Blaster what?
Up.
Jack used the ramp side of his Colt Python to raise the muzzle of the old man's pistol.
Keep blaster up.
Oh, yes, up. Up. Yes, indeed. You were suggesting that I hold a particularly high point of aim, considering the precipitous drop that my 44 will take after 50 yards. A loss of not only altitude, but of a good deal of penetration power.
The team nodded.
My dear Jack, what a glorious team you and I make.